Welcome to episode 325 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. I'm your host, Ian Martin, and today is a very special episode, an exclusive interview with the incredible Andrzej Bargiel. If that name doesn't mean anything to you yet, the chances are you will have seen him on YouTube or social media. In September 2025, Andrzej went viral after Red Bull released footage of him summiting and then skiing down Everest, the world's highest peak, without any extra oxygen. I referred to this in our interview, but to put his achievement into context, around 7,500 people have summited Everest, but fewer than 200 have managed to do it without supplementary oxygen, and absolutely none of them have skied back down. I suggest you watch a video first if you haven't seen it before you listen to this interview, and I'll put a link to it at the top of the show notes. Currently, it has 46 million views, and it's not surprising. I was on the edge of my seat at times, absolutely terrified. It's hard to grasp how monumentally difficult this challenge was, especially given the time of year. During our conversation, we cover Andrzej's journey from a challenging childhood in Poland via Skimo racing and then high mountain adventures to the specifics of how he became the first and only person to ski K2 from the summit, and then top that by completing his mind-blowing achievement on Everest. Andrzej is Polish, and while his English is good, he wanted to reply to questions in his native language. So in this conversation, you'll hear his words translated. It made this episode an immense feat of editing, but hopefully, after you've listened to it, you'll agree that it was worth it. Right, let's have a listen to my interview with Andrzej Bargiel, the first man to ski down Everest without oxygen. Hi, Andrzej. Welcome to the Ski Podcast. Jak się masz?
Cześć, mam się bardzo dobrze.
Thank you so much for your time today. I know listeners to the Ski Podcast are super interested in hearing about your incredible achievement. You've recently come back from Nanga Parbat in Nepal, and I have some questions about that later, but I wondered if we could start with how you became the guy who skis the highest peaks in the world without oxygen. You live in Zakopane, which I have been lucky enough to visit. I went about 10, 20 years ago, staying in refuges and fueled by Bigos and vodka. I read that you are the ninth of 11 children, and you had lots of energy as a child. You were very into sport, but you got your first skis when you were 9 years old by trading some table tennis bats for them. Is that right?
Tak, na pewno zacznę od początku. Cześć, witam cię i fajnie, że byłeś tutaj u nas.
Yes, I'm the ninth of my parents' 11 children. I have 10 siblings. And it's kind of super special because we basically didn't have any sports activities and our parents didn't take us skiing. We lived in the countryside. We worked on a small farm. And that's where we had to fight to be able to pursue our passions. My parents didn't support our sports activities because they were worried that something would happen to us. When you have so many children, it's a big problem, because statistically there is a greater chance that something will happen. So it was pretty wild, organic, and it feels like 100 years ago now. I appreciate it a lot, though, because the activities were so supernatural. We had two big boots, two long skis. I had skis that were for ski jumping. They were very old, so we cut them in half with a fence saw to get them to the right size. We never thought about whether our equipment was fashionable, whether it was the right color. The most important thing was to be able to do it, and it was such a pure, unadulterated passion, and I always remember that time.
Fantastic. That is really interesting to hear that. I think you loved skiing, you know, from an early age, and you often skip school to go skiing, but I think I'm right in saying that maybe one of your brothers was a ski patroller, and it was him who got you into ski touring.
Tak, to prawda. Ta szkoła nie była ważniejsza od nart.
Yes, that's true. School wasn't important when it was snowing. I took every opportunity to go skiing. It was super primitive. We carried our skis on our backs, went out on the slopes until it was dark. We didn't have sandwiches or anything to drink. But no one knew anything back then about nutrition. Such an important part of eventually being able to ski professionally was my older brother. It was thanks to him that I got to know the mountains. He was working on slope safety in Zakopane, and that helped me. He gave me a chance to do it on a professional level, and I also worked on the ski patrol. I had skis that were too long, but I toured all day, every day. I started competing, but I didn't have any equipment or any idea of how I was going to do it. I just assumed somehow that everything would work out. And in fact, relatively quickly, I managed to become Polish champion. Soon after, I made the World Cup podium in the juniors. That was despite the fact that pretty much everyone had written me off. They said I was too late to the sport, that I had no training background and no money. But I always had my passion. I was working against the current, in the sense that I had a hard time at home, but I didn't need people to pat me on the back. I knew I just needed to get on with it.
Yeah, I mean, that is such a brilliant story. It's very evident your passion for the sport. You got into racing, as you mentioned, and you had a lot of success, but you got a taste for mountaineering, I think, in 2012. And in 2013, you started the Hyksunt Lyones, Here Are Lions project, to ski the world's highest mountains. What prompted you to make that decision?
Tak, zaczynając od początku, na pewno takim trudnym momentem dla mnie było.
The problem with competing was I didn't have the money for it. And after the economic crisis in 2008, it was even harder to find sponsors. So it was too difficult to stay on the circuit, and I was looking for what to do next. An opportunity came up to go to the mountains. In Poland, we have a long tradition of Himalayan climbing, and I was invited onto a project called Polish Winter Himalayas, where we climbed 8,000ers in winter. It was thanks to Artur Haza, a Polish Himalayan climber, that I got involved. And that led to the Elbrus race in 2010, which I won. I was almost half an hour faster than Denis Shurupko, who was the fastest Himalayan climber in the world at that time. And that showed that I just worked well at high altitudes. Artur was trying to make me a winter climber, but that was never quite right. I was always looking for joy in sport, and these expeditions were so long. I just wasn't interested in sitting in a tent for 3 months just for a few days of activity. So that's where the Hyksunt Lyones project came from. My friend and I came up with it. It's Latin, and it literally means here are lions.
Wow, well, that is amazing. Clearly, you know, you thought about it and your direction has had a lot of input along the way. So I think we're going to come to, you know, discussing Everest. But before Everest, you skied on several 8,000 meter peaks. Can I ask how you have learned to function so well, so efficiently with so little oxygen?
Tak, na pewno ten sport był kluczowy. Właśnie jest tak.
In my early experiences in the Himalayas, I had the chance to practice at 7,000 meters and higher. And for me, my body has always felt good at high altitudes. I've always found it easy to adapt to high altitude and still be able to perform. If the conditions were good, I could climb 3 or 4,000 meters in a day comfortably. I did some great training in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan on 5 to 7,000 meter peaks. And in each case, I was climbing 3 to 4,000 meters of elevation gain at a time. K2 was, I think, crucial from the point of view of my mental strength, because I remember when I saw K2 for the first time, and I just thought, you know what, you could ski that from the summit. And I thought to myself, damn, someday someone will do that. But it didn't even occur to me at that time that I would be the person who would do it first.
Evidently, you referred to the risks, the dangers in climbing to these altitudes. And there are a lot of risks, and not just physiologically, but from the weather and from the glaciers. Has your attitude to risk changed as you've become more experienced?
Myślę, że na pewno takim ważnym elementem w kontekście ryzyka jest to.
The key is building experience in a reasonable way, so that any plans and challenges are appropriate to the moment. You can't just throw yourself at something you don't understand. Working on mountain rescue when I was younger was super valuable, because from the very beginning I had a lot of humility and respect for the mountains. And that was crucial because risk management is so important. I'm also an international alpine guide, so I've worked on these skills, but you have to develop them because you can't assume that you already know everything. You have to keep developing and building your knowledge.
So thinking about risk, I mean, you had previous attempts on Everest in 2019 and 2021, which were thwarted, I think, by a dangerous serac and then the weather closing in. Is it difficult to put a halt to your plans when you're so close like that?
Tak, na pewno to nie jest super easy.
It was easy to call them off. I've always joked that my greatest success was that I managed to organize those expeditions in the first place. Just financing them and making them happen is incredibly difficult. Fortunately, I can find peace within myself in difficult moments. I have a cool head, and I'm only going to take on a challenge if the situation is right.
To było dla mnie najtrudniejsze zawsze.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting listening to all of that. I mean, in English, we have a phrase, third time lucky. You did go back in September 2025 and you summited and you skied Everest without oxygen. And putting that into context, at 8,849 meters, the summit is a cruising height of a passenger jet. The air is so thin up there that climbers only get a third of the oxygen available at sea level. It's known as the death zone for a reason. And while more than 6,000 people have climbed it, fewer than 200 have ever done it without supplementary oxygen. Now, you mentioned that you particularly wanted to go in the autumn, and anyone who's watched the incredible videos on YouTube of your summit and your ski down, what struck me was exactly as you said. When you think of Everest these days, you think of queues of people waiting to summit, but there was no one there when you did it, which seems quite incredible to me.
Tak, na pewno wracając do Everestu, to była jakaś ciekawość, bo
chciałem... I didn't want to be on Everest with 5,000 people there. I can see for myself what's happening in these tourist places, in the Alps, in the Tatras. I don't want to be in the mountains when there's huge crowds there. I wouldn't be able to find what I'm looking for like that. In the spring, there's no snow. It's hard and icy. Plus, there's other expeditions and a trail that's like a highway. It's so wide. That was the reason why I fought for an autumn ascent when it's very difficult. But there are almost no people. There's a lot of snow and there's very few good weather windows. So you have a 5% chance that you'll summit, especially without oxygen. It's harder though, because there's a lot of snow and there's a significant avalanche risk. But the advantage of all that snow is that you don't see any ropes, any garbage, none of the remnants left behind by people who've been before you. It looks totally unspoiled. On my visit, I felt I was in a special place, and I'd been afraid that if I'd been there in the spring, it would have felt completely the opposite of that, and that I probably wouldn't like it. No one understands that in the autumn it's a completely different situation. I was well prepared, but the going was heavy, and there was a high avalanche risk. Being careful meant that on Everest, I was above 8,000 meters for 16 hours.
You mentioned that the chances of getting good weather in September are much lower. How long did you have to wait at Everest Base Camp before a window came up that looked like it would work?
Tak, na pewno ta pogoda, tak jak wspominałem, jest trudna.
The conditions definitely made it difficult. In the lead-up to the summit attempt, there was precipitation each day. Not much, but because it was warm, clouds formed over the Khumbu Glacier, with daily precipitation around noon. So, I used the time to help acclimatize, going up to Camp 2, and spending time on the glacier. It was difficult, though. Because it was warmer, the glacier was like sugar. It's not the kind of ice you can screw an ice screw into. Because of the conditions, I couldn't get any local help. They said they wouldn't do it. But I got to know the glacier well and found the solutions that I needed. And that meant I wouldn't need to use ropes or ladders, just take a natural line. I enjoyed the sense of solving a riddle, a complicated problem. When we moved up to Camp 3, we didn't climb on the classic route. Instead, I set up a route to the left of the couloir. I didn't want to go via the Lhotse face, because I was worried about the avalanche danger. I remember trying to dig a platform in solid ice at Camp 3 for about 5 hours. In the end, I managed to pitch the half of tent using an ice screw, but half of the tent was just in the air.
Wow. I mean, it's so interesting listening to everything that goes into it. If you watch a video on YouTube, you just don't really get any understanding of it at all. So you mentioned, you know, it was 16 hours of climbing because of the conditions, etc. You reached the top at 3 p.m. local time. You then had to put your skis on. What was going through your mind at that point?
Na pewno to było trudne, bo mój zespół...
It was unbelievable. It was tough, because my team at base camp had been trying to make me turn back. They'd seen the avalanche and were pretty concerned. They'd built up this problem in their heads and thought that we should call it off. I'm not a person who talks much. I have a team with me, and if I need something, I ask, but I rarely do. I was aware that clouds were coming up from the Tibetan side, and I was worried about losing visibility. And I could see time ticking away. It was late, but the sunset was super special. It was such an orange light that it added an extra level of significance to the situation. I had this awareness that I just had to keep moving. So I put on my skis and it was magical because there I was, on Everest, and I knew I was in this special place. You can see it in the video, in those first few meters. You know, I'm riding on my skis in soft powder snow at almost 9,000 meters, the level that passenger planes fly at. It will stay in my memory for a long time. It really was something super special.
I mean, one of the things that struck me was hearing you fighting for breath when you were skiing down. You know, on the audio, on the video, you can hear your breath. Am I right that just thinking at that altitude after such an effort already is as hard as breathing?
Na pewno to jesteś takim trochę trybie awaryjnym.
Fatigue is hard to deal with when you're in the mountains for so many hours. It's hard to replenish your energy. It's hard to drink enough water. So you're just in this kind of emergency mode the whole time, running an energy deficit. But I have a way that I can just calmly do these things and do them for a long time. I was super tired and the air was dry. My whole respiratory system was dry. That's a big limiter. When you have a dry cough like that, every breath is a mega effort. And at altitude, above 6,000 meters, you need a glass of water per hour just to breathe, for nothing more than breathing. It was a huge effort, but I was super focused. You can't allow that focus to slip, because that's when you get into difficulty.
Wow. Just amazing listening to everything. I mean, quite frankly, I was terrified watching you make your way back along the summit ridge. But you mentioned that you reached Camp 2, which is at 6,500 meters, by, I think, about 8:30 p.m. You had to wait until morning to negotiate the Khumbu icefall. Was the icefall more frightening than skiing the summit ridge?
Na pewno ja mam zawsze duży problem z zespołem.
I knew it was too late to go through the icefall because of the temperature. I had to be going through there before 8 a.m. when it was colder, so Camp 2 at 6,500 meters for the night was the only plan, the only strategy that would work in the situation. The team were more afraid than I was. They were trying to persuade me not to do the icefall or to just stay on the main route. They said that the path I'd chosen was falling apart, collapsing, that it didn't exist anymore. So I had to say to them, listen, leave me alone. I know what I'm doing. I understand it better than you do. It was difficult because this stress and fear doesn't contribute anything. All of a sudden, someone who has no experience is trying to give you directions. When Alex Honnold goes free solo, he doesn't have to listen to someone telling where to go. It was very difficult, and I was close to some very dangerous sections, but it was an amazing sense of satisfaction when I reached the bottom. It was a super interesting route, way more difficult than skiing the mountain. The mountain was dangerous from the point of view of avalanches, but it was enjoyable. The glacier was just very difficult.
I find that amazing. You know, you describe it as a lot of fun. I mean, I was terrified just watching you navigate your way down, because you know what it's like on a glacier. A glacier changes every day, and you're talking about, you know, fresh snow and everything like that. I have to ask you, what skis did you use for the descent? Because they've got to have a number of qualities. So they obviously need to be light because you're climbing up to 8,000 meters, but you need to be confident with them underneath your feet when you're skiing down incredibly steep slopes.
Tak, to ciekawe zagadnienie. Dzięki za miłe słowa.
When it came to equipment, there had to be some kind of compromise. I'd love to have super stiff boots and wide, long skis, but I had to carry my kit up there. And especially as I did it without oxygen, that would have required more effort. So it was a compromise. The skis were Salomon MTN 86 carbon skis, 176 centimeters long. Dynafit came up with special lightweight expedition bindings. The boots were a big challenge because it's very cold and you have to have boots that will keep your feet warm for hours at low temperatures. There's fatigue, low pressure, low temperatures, very little oxygen. All of that increases the feeling of coldness. I used ultralight Pierre Gignoux boots with overboots to help keep the heat in and my feet warmer.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. I spoke to Kit Delaurier, who is the first person to ski all of the seven summits, and she told me that she made herself some neoprene covers for her boots just to really try and focus on keeping your feet warm, which must be so important. So you've skied down Everest, K2, and recently this summer, Nanga Parbat. I wondered which was the hardest to climb and which was the hardest to ski?
Myślę, że na pewno mam jakieś porównanie, bo
I got the most tired on Everest. I just didn't realize that it would take so long. It was almost impossible to get your head around being at such a high altitude for so long. I was basically above 8,000 meters for almost a whole day. I think that when it comes to the descent, K2 was more satisfying. It was a combination of several routes, and while it was difficult, it was super satisfying.
I mean, it's so interesting talking with you, even though we're doing it in different languages. So you talk about a respect for the mountains, and I think all of our listeners have a huge amount of respect for everything that you've achieved. Just unbelievable. And what's really clear, I really enjoyed talking with you, is your passion. You know, that really comes out so strongly. You know, you're doing it for the pleasure and you're doing it for the enjoyment. And it's just been a real pleasure talking to you about it. So I'd like to thank you for your time today, Andrzej. I really appreciate it. Dziękuję. And, you know, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much. And
it was an absolute privilege to speak with Andrzej, and I hope you enjoyed listening to our conversation. Please do let me know what you thought of the interview and his achievement. You can leave a comment on Spotify, Instagram or Facebook, or you can drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. We're also on WhatsApp, where I release exclusive material ahead of each episode there. You can look in the show notes for all those links. We've had a bit of feedback recently. Matt Hayes said, thank you for the content over the summer. Some truly inspiring interviews. Also for the free ticket for the snow show. We got so much out of it last year and booked our hotel as soon as the dates came out. So the free ticket certainly helps. And listener, if you'd like free tickets to the London snow show, then all the details are at theskipodcast.com. Colin Tierney enjoyed episode 323 when I spoke with Virginia Anderson from Disability Snowsport UK. He said, very interesting episode. Disabled skiers impressed me so much. And he mentions he's seen visually impaired skiers when he's been at Hemel Hempstead, the Snow Centre South. Jake Roscoe has been catching up with our back catalogue over the summer and mentioned that he really enjoyed episode 235 when you spoke with Nancy Scheel from Big Sky Resort in Montana. There are now 325 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. 181 of those were listened to in the last week alone. We are now in September, and to quote a phrase, winter is coming. So if you want to build up your knowledge before the new season, then just go to theskipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to listen to. That is it for this week. The Ski Podcast will be back next week with another regular episode. For now, I would like to thank Andrzej Bargiel for his time. He is a pretty amazing man, and I really enjoyed speaking with him. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.